The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 265, Teaching Confessions to Saints, a non-LDS professor and her LDS students, by Linda Haverty Rugg.
Okay, it says begin on time. These are my instructions. Begin on time. I'm Jean Winder. And I will introduce the speakers for now. The session is an hour long. It'll be a 30-minute presentation, more or less, and then 15 minutes by Nyla over there, and then it will be open for questions. So let me introduce our people here. Linda Haverty, am I saying that right?
Haverty.
Oh, I'm sorry. Linda Haverty Rugg is an assistant professor of German and Scandinavian at Ohio State University. She has a PhD in 1989 from Harvard in comparative literature, visiting professor in 1993 to 1994 at BYU, Department of German and what?
Slavic.
And Slavic. Okay. She says, my husband and I are both from Nebraska, although they live in Ohio now. We love to watch birds and found the lake at a particularly good place for cinnamon teals. I'm not a fisherman. And American coots. I hope that's right. My daughter says, don't spend time taking your time talking. Let them have the time. So that's what I'm going to do. And then we have Sesha Chari. Did I say it right?
Yes.
She'll tell you right if it isn't right. Neela Seshachari. And she is from Weber State. She teaches at Weber State. Now, what did I do with your paper? I don't know.
Don't
oh, it was here. Oh. No, this. She's a professor of English and editor of the 8 years of the Weber Studies at Weber State University. And she has a PhD from the University of Utah in 1975. So without further ado, we will go like that until it's time for questions and you've met our presenters.
Thank you. Well, I'm very happy to see all of you here. Please let me know if this is too loud or too soft. I'm grateful that I was allowed to come here and speak to you today about my experiences at BYU. I taught at BYU, as you heard just now, this last academic year as a visiting professor in the Department of German and Slavic as the person who was doing the Scandinavian program. They needed a person to replace someone who had gone, who had taken a job elsewhere. And so my position at BYU was strictly temporary. I was only going to be there for 1 year. I have a tenure-track position at Ohio State in the German department. And so this position was granted to me as a favor. It was a godsend, actually, because I'm trying to finish a book in order to get tenure. And while I was at BYU, the tenure clock stopped. And hopefully that's going to be enough to allow me to finish my book and get tenure at Ohio State. But I'm saying all of this to you so that you understand from the beginning that it wasn't my intention to stay at BYU permanently. And so the argument that I'm going to be making about the new hiring policy is not about my own case, but it's a universal argument. It's an argument about principle. Okay. Of course, I knew when I took my visiting position at Brigham Young University that the university was a Mormon institution. But I had the idea that the most distinctive feature of the religion had something to do with not drinking alcohol or coffee. I knew that Utah was conservative. I had heard that. And I also understood that feminism was not precisely encouraged. Shortly before I was to come out to Utah, one of my colleagues at Ohio State very kindly put a copy of our professional publication, The Chronicle of Higher Education, in my box with an article about Cecilia Farr's case highlighted in yellow. You know, look what you're going to be dealing with here. It was not very encouraging to read this in my professional journal, my national professional journal. But I told myself that I was only going to be there for a year, and I had, in my travels in other places, met Mormon people who had impressed me very much, so I knew that this was not necessarily the whole story. I left for BYU with a copy of the Book of Mormon in my suitcase, a gift from a colleague at OSU who is a member of the church. I did not, unfortunately, take the time to read it, and I had only a dim understanding of what the book was. I didn't know what it was really supposed to be. I suppose there are people, and perhaps even people in this room, who are dismayed at the idea of a professor teaching at Brigham Young University with such poor credentials, that is, zero credentials in LDS theology. In retrospect, I feel a little shocked about it myself when I think back on this situation. But it was precisely my ignorance, coupled with the desire to become less ignorant, that created a unique learning and teaching situation. As an example, I would like to discuss the dynamics of a class I gave during the winter semester in the admittedly esoteric topic of Scandinavian autobiography. And for some people, anything having to do with Scandinavian is esoteric, but Scandinavian autobiography is pushing the envelope. I'd like to insert here very quickly that I'd originally planned to give this paper in a non-Mormon academic setting, and so some of the arguments that I present have to do with literary theory, but I've tried to express myself with as much clarity as possible under the circumstances. As might be expected, this class in Scandinavian autobiography is rather small, only 9 students, but they impressed me with their ability and their interest. The study of autobiography has been the central focus of my research for more than 10 years now, and during that time I've offered several courses dealing with autobiographical literature and theory. The object of this course, like other courses, was to introduce the students to the tradition of autobiographical literature in Scandinavia, where it is a very important tradition, which you may not know. But I also meant to explore with them some essential questions. What is autobiography? How does it differ from fiction? If autobiography is self-writing, what is a self? How is a self formed? Is it first formed in the autobiographical text itself? Do autobiographies refer to a real world beyond the text? If so, how does a reader learn about that real world through a text? What is an author? How do we know that the author and the person described in the autobiography are the same? These questions, which may seem at first glance fanciful or unnecessarily tortured, represent some of the central issues in literary study today, because they explore the relationship between literature and the world, between language and the world, between literature and history. I assigned an essay to the class by the French theorist Michel Foucault, who claims that the author exists only in his or her texts, that an author, and that's in quotation marks, is not a human being at all, but a function. For example, when we speak of Shakespeare, we really mean the body of works written by something we identify with the word Shakespeare. For example, you use the word Shakespeare in this way. In all of Shakespeare, we find a concern with the fate of kings. And when we say that, we're not talking about a biological Shakespeare in which we open up and find the fate of kings. If we were to discover a new cache of texts signed with the name Shakespeare, or discover that they had actually been written by someone named Ben Jonson, the entity we understand to be Shakespeare would be transformed. In this reading, the individual born in Stratford-upon-Avon has existence only through his texts. To give you an idea of the extremity of Foucault's theory, Foucault distinguishes between the living corpus of text, the body of text, and the dead corpse of the biographical author, who is of no account anymore. In another assigned essay, an essay assigned to the class, another French person, Paul de Man, well, actually he's Belgian, I'm sorry, he argues that no true distinction exists between autobiography and fiction, because the self formulated in the autobiography is a fictional construct. That is, you make it up as you go along. Since autobiography is fiction, it is unimportant whether there is any truth value in what the autobiographer writes. They can say whatever they want. The text need not be factual. Philippe Lejeune, another Frenchman, on the other hand, hoping to establish a link between the real world and the autobiographical texts, insists that a true autobiography can be recognized if the name on the title page is the same as that of the narrator and of the protagonist of the tale. This is his test. He calls his rule the autobiographical pact because it implies a kind of contract of faith between the reader and the writer, both of whom exist in a world in which signatures guarantee responsibility. So in Lejeune's idea, the name of the author is going to guarantee, his name on the dotted line will say, well, this is a true text, and I'm the person who told it. The idea that an apparently historical text might actually be fiction masquerading as history, and that a signed contract would be necessary to ensure a text's validity, is unsettling to most people at first brush. I had worked through these various essays with students before. They hate them, by the way. And they had always posed philosophical and sometimes political problems. We would have discussions about them. But I had not reckoned the impact of such ideas in a community where testimony is of central importance. If I had bothered to take a closer look at the Book of Mormon, that is, open the cover, before entering the classroom, I would have seen the signatures attesting to the existence of the golden plates and the appearance of the angel, and I might have had a better idea of how my Mormon students would read these essays. What was fascinating and exciting to me as a teacher was the stake my students had in these ideas. It was not simply a question, as it had been in other classes that I taught, of understanding difficult theories, which they complained bitterly about. The BYU students were quick to understand precisely because they had to take a position regarding testimony, selfhood, and authorship. They immediately understood that there was something very serious going on here. What if, one of my students asked, we say, that Joseph Smith is an author function. Because Joseph Smith is understood to be a prophet, an individual chosen by God to reveal truth, is it not important that we understand his texts as written by his hand? Would it make a difference if we discovered that some of the texts ascribed to Joseph Smith were produced by another person who is not recognized as a prophet? Are the texts received as prophetic because a prophet, a person, writes or speaks them, or isn't an individual prophetic because of his texts? What about the issue of truth value? Suddenly we were working with a theory that mattered, that was not an abstraction or a game. Of course, I had always felt a personal stake in discussing ideas of selfhood and authorship, otherwise I would not have devoted so many years to the study of autobiography. But the nature of academic writing, which tends to efface the academic writer, you're not supposed to talk about yourself, did not force me or even allow me to come to grips with the source of my concern. In the BYU classroom, the students wanted to know about my testimony. What did I think about the ramifications of some of these theories? If we were to follow the theory to its logical conclusion, where would it lead us? I was incited, for the first time, to go beyond throwing out ideas in the classroom, which is my normal function. You know, here's an idea, you guys play with the idea. The discussions with my students helped me to clarify my own position and the reasons that I would like to argue for an author who creates a text rather than a text that creates an author. This was something that was part of my argument, but I didn't recognize it as part of my argument until I had spoken to my students about it. This has made a difference in my scholarly work. Our exploration of the problems surrounding autobiography affirmed for me that belief in selfhood and authorship is, if not precisely religious, at least a matter of faith. This becomes clear when I cite another statement from the theorist Philippe Lejeune, the man who invented the autobiographical pact, who somewhat sheepishly acknowledges his desire to continue believing in a subject outside language. He writes, and this is a quote, "It's better to get on with the confessions. Yes, I have been fooled. I believe that we can promise to tell the truth. I believe in the Holy Ghost of the first person." And I think it's very interesting that in this secular setting, that even in even parodying himself, that he feels that he has to use the language of faith to talk about these issues, because it's obviously we can't prove them in some significant way. But so he's embarrassed, but he invokes his Catholic background. Another discovery further moved me to an examination of my method and presence in the classroom. I had chosen a group of autobiographies characterized by a certain irreverence and a penchant for experimentation. This was my syllabus. Particularly Nietzsche's autobiography and August Strindberg's autobiography, and some of you may be familiar with Strindberg, were written to challenge the boundaries of autobiography and conventions of selfhood and all other kinds of conventions as well. While the students were reading these often radical autobiographies and the radical essays in theory, they were supposed to be thinking about how they would write their own autobiographies. It has become something of a cliche that courses in autobiography require students to write autobiographical texts of their own. I have found it, however, to be a useful exercise because it is when students are engaged in making choices about how to frame their own narratives about their own lives that they become most aware of the nature of the choices that they have to make. Whom to address? What tone to adopt? What to include, and perhaps more importantly, what to leave out? What order to follow? All of these matters acquire greater importance when considered in one's own case. So after they'd done it themselves, they could see what was happening in some of these other people's work. My tactic was to ask the students to write a very short 1 to 2 page sketch during the first week of class. I then required them to revise and lengthen the sketch as a final project and to append a 5-page analysis of their own autobiographical technique. Here, once again, my ignorance of Mormon culture brought me up short. Once the first sketches had been handed in, several of my students approached me. They were concerned that their sketches had been too formulaic, and indeed, I had noticed striking similarities between them. Almost all the writers focused on their religious experience as the central motif in their lives, and they weren't writing for their religious professor. So further, that religious experience was defined in much the same terms from student to student. Childhood instruction in religion from parents and family, missionary experience, which was often denoted as a kind of conversion to true personally held faith. The missionary experience was almost like a conversion experience. And the foundation, finally, or the planned foundation of a family within the church. So they moved from family to missionary experience and then back into family as their autobiographical discourse. And this was true of 8 out of 9 students. This is how they structured their life story. In our opening discussions of the history and evolution of autobiography, however, right at the time they were writing these sketches, I had told them that Rousseau's Confessions, the first book on our list, and we just read a part of it, represented a break with religious confession back in 1790-something, and the beginning of a new secular era in autobiographical writing. Religious confession, according to the model that I had set up, was strictly retrograde. In other words, it was not an acceptable model. Further, the books I had listed on the syllabus distinguished themselves precisely in their experimental nature. Challenging generic tradition received high marks on my syllabus, while clinging to old models of selfhood, religious models, consigned authors to the hell of the unread. My students were bright. This pattern did not go unnoticed. But they were also committed to a peculiar autobiographical practice of which I knew nothing. As you are all aware, and as I am now aware, Mormonism depends on personal testimony. Members are encouraged to write personal histories of faith, which cannot be said to be strictly autobiographical in a traditional sense because they are usually also accounts of family history rather than an isolated individual's history. My students had come to class with the experience of keeping journals and bearing witness, and these foundational elements formed the basis for their autobiographies. They were St. Augustine's, and I was looking for Nietzsche's. Or at least that was how the matter seemed at first. Here we must keep in mind what often is forgotten once one leaves the classroom. Within the classroom, one individual gets to determine the value system. The classroom is essentially a dictatorship and not always a benevolent one. The instructor maps out not only what is required, but what is desirable, what is correct, what is appropriate, what is inappropriate. I have learned that despite the anti-authoritarian tendencies tenderly nurtured during my childhood in the 60s, when the semester is over, I still must fill in the little bubble on the data sheet under A, B, C, and so on. It is my ethical responsibility to make sure that the system for filling in those bubbles is as clear to my students and myself as possible. But in this class, my system was dealt a serious blow. It seemed that my practice of assigning points, whether consciously or unconsciously, for a particular kind of originality was going to have to be brought into question. I decided to explore this matter with my students, who were understandably uneasy about the application of my standard of judgment to their traditional autobiographical practice. In fact, they were caught between two structures of authority, one coming from the instructor in the classroom, and one coming from a higher source, either institutional or spiritual. We talked together about Mormon autobiographical practice in relation to postmodern concepts of selfhood and autobiographical authorship, and that perhaps is one of the first times that's been done in the classroom there. These discussions led to a surprisingly diverse array of confessional approaches among the students, even though the central focus of religious experience was still the defining factor. One student submitted her journal, which she'd written from the time she was 17 to the time she was in class, which charted her conversion from Catholicism to Mormonism and the sometimes painful process of growing into the community. She wrote in her very insightful commentary about the immediacy and intimacy of journal writing as opposed to the analytical discourse of autobiography. Another student submitted poems and a short piece of fiction she'd written during her mission in Taiwan. She reflected on the factual distortions that occurred in the transformation of life experience into fiction and poetry, but she wondered whether deviations from fact actually entailed distortions of truth. Yet another student put together a film made from video clips from his childhood with an overvoice commentary. He wrote an analysis of, he actually also used an ultrasound film of his baby, of his own baby, as the prelude, and he introduced the baby as being himself, which I thought was very interesting deconstructive practice. He wrote an analysis of the split that naturally occurs when the older self talks about the younger self. You can really see that in a film situation. And commented on the relationship between the two selves, the feelings of distance and alienation brought about by self-analysis, but also the sense of continuity and evolution in a life. One student revisited an episode in his life where a kind of trauma had occurred. He had been abused and treated as an outcast in his high school because of his insistence on adhering to certain principles of his faith, and this high school was obviously not in Utah. His analysis studied the possibility of creating a healing autobiographical narrative as therapy, I guess you'd say. Finally, I permitted one of my students to submit an autobiographical text originally written for a class in genealogy the previous year. His text was the most conservative in terms of its approach, and his analysis was among the most interesting in the class. With the distance of a year between the autobiography and commentary, he was able to examine his motivations and methodology quite critically, and this was a traditional methodology. He recognized that his autobiography presented an idealized self, in part because of its intended audience he was going to give it to his descendants. He had omitted discussions of sexuality. He had rearranged the chronology to create a kind of evolution. He'd changed the time of events. He had sometimes made a hero of himself in situations where he originally felt far from heroic. His analysis represented a true confrontation with his self-image, and it was often brutally honest, his analysis. But it was, in fact, the conjunction of the autobiographical text and its critical analysis that made the final paragraph of his autobiography ring true. This paragraph began, "And now in conclusion, I would just like to give my testimony. Of course I understand now that the gesture of giving testimony, that might not be the right verb, is it bearing or giving or bringing testimony, is a formulaic one. Perhaps all the students in his genealogy class wrote essentially the same closing paragraph. But in the context of what we had discussed together in class and what he had written as a result in his self-analysis, I felt that the act of testimony had achieved a greater resonance. It certainly had for me as a reader, and I think that it had for him as a writer as well. From the comments of the other students, I understand that this was the case for most of them." This is what they said about writing their autobiographies. "The act of calling into question or deconstructing the form in which testimony takes place more firmly anchored the author's faith and allowed them to experiment with new forms at the same time. It had not been my intention as a teacher to use a critical approach to autobiography in order to encourage more difficult and searching forms of confession in my students. I did not know that they were in the habit of making confessions. I simply presented them with models from a secular world, and they confronted those models with their own. This, I feel, would not have taken place in quite the same way in a classroom where the professor and the students were both thoroughly rooted in the same tradition, had the same kinds of expectations. This brings me to my final point. While I was at BYU, it seems that a shift in policy occurred. I say that it seemed so because one heard variant reports of whether a real change was taking place, what the form of that change exactly was, what its implications were, and so on. However, because I was peripherally involved in discussions regarding a couple of faculty appointments, I was able to see, from the reaction of my senior colleagues, that a definitive change in attitude and actual policy had indeed taken place. While in the past, BYU's hiring policy had stated a preference, a strong preference, for members of the LDS Church, with the result that only a very small percentage of the faculty are not members, and I think it's less than 10%. Now it had been decided that no new tenure-track appointments of non-members would be made. I am not here to argue that a university staffed entirely by excellent Mormon scholars would be impossible. Clearly, it would be possible. I have two questions, however, to which I will pose tentative answers, and I invite my respondent and audience to take these questions up for themselves. First, what is the origin of such a policy? And second, is such a policy desirable? My impression is that the decision to enact a definitively exclusionary policy must have arisen from a sense that the BYU community is threatened by inimical foreign forces. In this view, secular visions of the world, such as those I presented to my class, threaten the protective barrier erected by the institution for its students. However, those few faculty members who do not belong to the church make an agreement upon being hired to sublimate their difference. It's a very, I said in my original, I said it was a tacit agreement, but it's not a tacit agreement. You go, you talk to the general authority, and the general authority says, you know, will you do X, Y, and Z? And you say yes, and you'll be good, and so on and so forth. And so you know precisely what the conditions are when you enter. Because non-members are not part of the church community, they do not in any case speak to the students with an authoritative theological voice. These students are very much steeped in theology by the time they come to BYU, and they're not in the habit, I think, of listening to outsiders on the issue of theology necessarily. Observations from non-members on any issue that touches on the fringes of theology or doctrine will be taken by students as external, possibly uninformed, and certainly not definitive. My experience with BYU students indicates that the great majority of them are so firmly grounded in their faith or culture that the threat actually runs in the other direction. Non-members will find themselves examining and defending their own set of beliefs. The conversion practice is not running from the few non-LDS members there to the students. It's going the other way. Okay. I would argue that the threat the institution feels actually arises, and this is not going to come as any surprise to you, from challenges issued from within the membership of the church. This seems substantiated by the recent excommunications and dismissals. The issue of difference and diversity among saints, which the church will, of course, be confronting more and more in the next century, needs to be addressed within the community and not projected as a danger emanating from non-members in the community. During my year at BYU, I was consistently impressed with the varieties of faith within the Mormon community and by the intense intellectual engagement with religious and other ideas among many of my colleagues. A denial or effacement of diversity among the saints would, in my opinion, impoverish the university, and I think that that's really what this exclusionary policy is about. It's about the denial of, or the exclusion of difference. My second question involves the implications of the new policy. As I have tried to demonstrate in my discussion of our course in Scandinavian autobiography, cultural difference treated with respect can create a kind of good tension in the classroom. The saints are a minority in the greater American culture and an often misunderstood minority at that. BYU, in maintaining an overwhelming majority of LDS faculty and students, produces an environment in which the minority culture becomes dominant. Students develop a sense of their identity as part of a worldwide community, and they can re-enter the secular or non-Mormon world with an increased sense of security and purpose, and that's the upside. At the same time, however, I think that all of us are aware of the pitfalls of belonging to a dominant culture. It is possible in such a situation for a false sense of intellectual security or superiority to develop. And even in an institution devoted to the teachings of Jesus Christ, it is possible for prejudice against outsiders to develop. The presence of non-members who at the same time are integral parts of the BYU community offers a guard against such developments. In my presence, my students spoke carefully of their own traditions and beliefs and respectfully of mine because they cared about me. This is something that occurs most easily in relationships through repeated interaction. They were forced to hold up their assumptions for comparison, and they were given the opportunity to teach the teacher, a reversal that provided much enjoyment and entertainment because I was so completely ignorant. For my part, I found that while the students were well prepared for university study and diligent workers for the most part, they sometimes lacked knowledge of other religious traditions, and that's actually a glaring understatement. Many of my students had no notion, for example, of what Lent is. When I said that now it's Lent, and they're like, what is Lent? Many others did not know that Muslims believe in the God of Abraham from our Old Testament. And one student who had served a mission in Sweden, who lived in Sweden for quite a long time, asked me whether Lutherans professed to be Christians. It might have just been provocative, but it didn't seem to be a joke. My presence in the classroom as a non-Mormon seemed to spur them to ask questions about other faiths, even faiths about which I myself know very little. The mere fact of my difference brought a kind of authority of otherness into play. I was the other person, and they could ask me about any other religion, even though I didn't know anything about it. In our relationship with one another, we constantly defined ourselves. This had the productive effect of forcing us into self-inspection. What do I believe? How can I explain myself to this person without giving offense or sacrificing my own position? How do I form a community with this person who is different from me in an essential way? I think that this exercise was important for my students. I know it was for me. One might argue that since this situation occurred during a visiting professorship, it might be more desirable to appoint visiting or temporary non-members to the faculty. But I would say that the thing that was lacking in my relationship with my students was a sense of permanence, my sense of permanence in the community. It would have added something to the good tension of our discussions if I were a permanent member of the community who would always remain an outsider, but always also on the inside with them. In closing, let me offer my testimony. I have rarely felt as appreciated and loved in my work as I was at BYU. The word love does not often enter into discussions of academic life, for good reason. But here it is not misplaced. Naturally, there were moments when I felt uncomfortable, and there were things I did not like about the institution. And if you want to ask me about them sometime, I'll tell you. Occasionally, I would run across a person who did not strike me as the most sincere practitioner of his or her faith. I did not convert to Mormonism as a result of my stay, but I did undergo a kind of conversion, if we take the word in its original sense as a way of turning. I turned into someone who is actively interested in and cares about the welfare of the community at BYU and the Mormon community generally. If the doors of the university are closed to the idea of non-members as permanent residents, it will be more difficult for such conversions to take place. I can already feel that it must be difficult for those non-members who have made their careers at the university to come to terms with this new policy. I am aware that from my position on the outside, it would be presumptuous to try to dictate to or judge a community that is ultimately not mine. So please take my observations in the spirit that I have tried to make them, hoping to create a good tension with kindness. I am grateful to BYU for my year there, and I would like to thank my colleagues and my students at Brigham Young for the time we spent together. I'd also like to thank the organizers of Sunstone for making my participation possible, and I'd finally like to thank all of you for listening.
Before I begin my response, I want to make give a 30-second bite to Weber Studies. Weber Studies has just completed 11 years, but on our 10th anniversary issue was devoted to tradition and the individual talent in contemporary Mormon letters, and this received the AMLs Award for contribution to Mormon thought or Mormon letters, I think. Service to Mormon letters. And for any of you who are interested in owning a copy or seeing it, it's at the desk, the Sunstone desk, or you might want to see some of these brochures later. Needless to say, I was fascinated by Linda Haverty Rugg's paper because we share many common things. For instance, she emphasizes the challenges that non-LDS professors face in LDS institutions. And of course, I too teach at Weber State, which is a predominantly has a predominant LDS student body. Linda, I would say, is an outsider, whereas I think of myself as an inside outsider. Given my 25 years of teaching at Weber State, my charter membership in the AML, that is the Association for Mormon Letters, and my penchant for attending Sunstone Symposia. So that makes me an inside outsider. I would like to assure Linda that no matter how much one has read about a culture, especially the Mormon culture, one really does not understand it unless one has lived in it for 25 years. I had read a number of brochures on Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, had convinced even my American friends that Mormons indeed did not have horns. I mean, we did this in India. I knew Mormons were teetotalers, but I was still in for a lot of surprises. There is another similarity in Linda's and my case, we discovered. I, too, have been interested in autobiography, and I indeed taught courses on autobiography for 7 years until I became the editor and had to give up, jettison some of my teaching to take on the editorship. So as a peer who taught a similar course, I have some questions. By the way, I taught courses on women's autobiography, and 1 year I even called it Witch, Bitch, Goddess, or Human Being. autobiographies of contemporary women. And I actually attracted two male students. They wanted. So I think I would like to raise some questions, first on autobiography, because I think they are linked to very closely to our relationship with the spiritual, with our conviction of what is true and not true, with our conviction of what we believe in. By the way, that was something new to me. I'd never pondered much about what I believed in, because Hinduism is very eclectic. You want to believe in this or that, go ahead and believe, as long as you are fascinated with the idea. So the question used to bother me a great deal when I first came in. What do you believe in? My beliefs change depending on the occasion. Anyway, so I would like to raise some questions on autobiography. For instance, the demarcation between fiction and fact as autobiography, even in autobiography, is alarmingly seamless. Where does fact end and fiction begin, even in autobiography? Fictive autobiographical texts are sustained by social context. There is a creative intertextuality between fact and fiction. One upholds and sustains the other. Michel Foucault's idea that the author is ultimately a function, the living corpus of text versus the corpse of the dead writer, and Philippe Lejeune's idea of the autobiographical pact, where we know something is true because I give the testimony, guaranteeing authenticity or responsibility thereof, get hopelessly mingled. Then again, what is selfhood? And this is very important when we talk of religion and intercultural relationships. There is the problem of the author as well as the author's or reader's own ideas about the implied author. And the implied author is that imaginary author we think there exists in a text. For instance, I may be reading a James Baldwin, and I know James Baldwin was black. Therefore, I expect the author to behave and behave in certain ways and believe certain things. So there is that question. In writing autobiographical exercises, the hardest task for the student is to determine what kind of persona to create. Any life can lend itself to creating at least a couple of persona. You know, we have God's plenty in us, and we can be like chameleons, change our personalities. So what personality to posit there? And again, writing autobiographies is a critical act. I have one comment on journal writing versus writing autobiography. Journal writing need not be critical. And I think many journals are just, many journals, especially written by students, are just records of what they did during the day. And in journals, one can simply record happenings without analyzing them mentally or on paper. Writing an autobiography necessarily entails exercising one's critical judgment. For instance, we cannot string 10 years of journals together and say, this is my autobiography. It has to have a shape and a form and a critical structure to it. So therein lies the difficulty in making students write autobiographical assignments. You had problems with the centrality of testimony in Mormon religious teachings. And this centrality makes critical thinking not only difficult but unacceptable for students. It's very hard to go against something that is posited as a testimony. We have only to remember the purge of critical thinkers from the BYU faculty last year, and that's what you were referring to, that these faculty were not really non-scholarly or unpublished, but their pristine primary sin was that they were critical thinkers. They were, quote, good professors who are required. Like the Hippocrates rule for physicians, the primary rule for professors is that they be critical thinkers, and they had. So, another comment on the paper, Linda's experience at BYU convinced her that an author creates a text rather than vice versa. I mean, that's what you came to, is what you say. And I had to chuckle. Yeah. You lived, you steeped yourself too much in BYU atmosphere. I'm skeptical. Creative writers will recognize immediately how a fiction in one's head gets totally transformed into something else as one begins to write it. I mean, there are some writers here. You may have it in your head, but it doesn't come out. That's because the stronger the created characters, the more they determine their own actions. It's not the writer who determines the characters run away. The more inciting the situations, the more likely it is to get out of the writer's hands. And the same is true of autobiographies. So that was my... And I have some thoughts about selfhood expressed in Linda's paper too. In Mormon Utah, at least, the creation of selfhood as I see as an activity quite antithetical to a religious action. And what I mean by it is, in following the Mormon doctrine, one cannot take any liberties. And yesterday I was raising questions about minimal sets. If minimal sets are negotiable, then one cannot be a, quote, true Mormon. Because the Mormon is given a set of criteria or set of beliefs. One has to follow the doctrines and covenants and the words of wisdom, and one's power comes out of obedience to outside authority. That's the religious authority. The power is derived from the religious authority by following, by obedience. It is secondary power. Every individual, in that sense, has secondary power derived, ironically, from obedience. Do you get what I'm saying? It is obedience that brings one power in a Mormon setting. Creating selfhood in a very genuine sense is an act of imagination and faith that empowers the individual. There's no power in somebody else. There is power in the individual. So it is very antithetical, I think. So... And I'm therefore fairly appreciative of Linda's reversal of student evaluations. While she formally based her grades on challenging of a generic tradition, she became appreciative of the sensitive and original way of handling traditional material. And I predict, I mean, you say your students loved you, and I guarantee that. Yeah, you know, no learning can take place unless the professor is in sync with or empathetic to the students. I mean, I'm glad she discovered that it is possible to write a good autobiography within the traditional structures. I was thinking to myself, Linda did not know about the testimonies and the confessions. How is one to know about worthiness interviews within weeks of coming to campus? One question Linda raises is about inimical foreign forces on campus, as she calls them, and the recent policy, and the recent BYU policy of keeping tenure away from people who do not belong to the faith. Ultimately, Mormonism is a religion that prevents its followers from seeking truth in their own way, be it through their atheism, agnosticism, intellectual pursuits, or devotion. It allows only testimonies to prove spiritual truth. And such an institution or such a religion is likely to be afraid of any kind of genuine inquiry. And I think some of you may not even understand what I'm talking about. As a Hindu, I have no articles of faith to follow. I cannot be a Jack Hindu, no matter what I do, or a Jain Hindu. I cannot be a Jain Hindu, no matter what I do. If I'm an atheist, if I say I'm an atheist, the Hindu priest will say, you poor thing, you go and study some more and do a genuine, sincere inquiry, and you will one day come to the conclusion that spirituality exists, that there is a creator, that you will discover God. So in that sense, Hinduism has room for atheists, agnostics, believers, non-believers. And so, and in Mormonism, one cannot question anything. One can only affirm through testimonies. So, I have one comment about your hope that cultural pluralism at BYU. Linda is hopeful that cultural differences treated with respect can create a good tension in the classroom. And these are her words, of course. I have not seen in my 25 years in Utah a genuine respect for other cultures or other religions on my campus or on any campus. I have scores of personal anecdotal stories which led me to this conclusion. LDS missionaries go to Eastern countries, especially to Japan and China, and they don't know anything about Chinese or Japanese religion or culture, and they go there. I've been told by some of my own LDS friends that it is so hard to convert Hindus because they can believe in Jesus Christ and Joseph Smith without giving up their Hinduism. I mean, they can believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ and Joseph Smith and not give up Hinduism. Tolerance in Utah is tolerance tinged by glorification of the Mormon culture or one's own culture, any culture, as having the whole truth, and the recognition of the inferiority of the other as having only part of the truth. And that is disturbing to me. You know, any time we speak, the attitude is, oh yeah, this is the true church. The subtext is, your church or your temple or whatever it is inferior, either because it has no truth or because it has part of the truth. And tolerance in Utah is, well, I'm superior, but I tolerate you, you're there. For me, it is an unacceptable notion. Tolerance has to have a healthy respect for both. You believe in the taco, I believe in the roti, somebody believes in the hamburger, and we all get our nourishment the way we want, and we agree to believe in different things, and we respect each other for believing in different things. I mean, that I respect. Mormonism is obvious. I wouldn't be here otherwise. And we wouldn't be here by choice, teaching for 25 years. But I think the word tolerance itself has to be redefined, rethought. Secularism in India is a healthy respect for all religions. In the United States, secularism is no respect for, is a person who has no religion. So words need to be defined. Love for the other, tolerance for the other, needs to be redefined, revisioned in that sense. And so there is room in Utah for cultural understanding. And one last thing before I end. I'm sorry. Okay. Permanence, Linda felt that her permanence in a Mormon community would have created that tension and understanding. I have a problem. I've encountered a problem with that. Young, impressionable Mormons are told over and over again to guard against Satan, who comes into society in many wily forms, often sweet-sounding, logical, and intellectually attractive. In other words, Satan can visit a society in the form of a Socratic professor. Okay? And so, what do professors like Linda and I do? My own testimony to all the foregoing, to live in Utah as a professor is an act of one's own non-Mormon faith for academics like Linda and me. I have lived here and taught here by choice. I love the challenge, and Linda would have loved it too had her circumstances brought her permanently into Mormondom. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Aren't we glad that we know people that aren't LDS so we can learn something other than just what we hear all the time? Appreciate your talks very much. And now we will have just a few minutes for questions. Let's ask them quickly. Any questions you might have?
Well, last year at the Sunstone Symposium, someone expressed the fear that BYU would become the Bob Jones of the West. Do you see that happening?
I think that there's one of the reasons I came here was because I was concerned about my students and I was concerned about the BYU community. Another reason I'm here is because I'm concerned about the quality of academics generally, the quality of the profession. And yes, I think that if one becomes too exclusive, if one embraces a too narrow a scope of values, I don't know about Bob Jones, but Oral Roberts at least think for the possibility. I think that it really inhibits scholarly inquiry, and it obviously has stifled people, the people who were ejected, dismissed, and the people who remain and are forced to consider very carefully their steps or live with the constant threat of being dismissed. So yeah, I think it is a real threat, and if the institution wants to be a leading research institution, which is one of its proclaimed goals, then it has to be less exclusive, I think. That's one of the dangers. Yeah.
This is more a comment than a question. Being an outside insider, does that work? that having gone to BYU 20 years ago, I just mourned that I didn't get to go when you were there. I mourned that only nine students get diversity.
Yeah, well,
I know when I was there, I craved it. Yeah. And I wanted critical thinking, and I wanted introspective search for identity. Yeah. And you can't get it without.
Well, thank you very much. I want to be careful to say also that many of my colleagues are very much involved in the same exactly the same kind of critical approaches that I'm interested in. For example, Michelle is sitting next to you, and Scott is sitting back there. So, one of my arguments is not that I brought that to the university. It's there, but one of the dangers is that in this whole exclusionary practice, that it's going to become less and less easy. To do this kind of rigorous study that the LDS faculty are doing as well as the non-LDS.
Back here.
Would you care to share with us something of your experience with faculty as opposed to
students? Well, I was in the German and Slavic department, and that particular department I later came to understand from talking to people was actually a hotbed of insurrection. as much as a hotbed of insurrection could exist in that climate. And that's perhaps not exactly fair. But I would say that my colleagues in the department were extraordinarily welcoming and warm. Three of them are here today. And I was treated with great respect. My ideas were listened to. I was very happy with my colleagues. Now, I understood that if I ventured too far in other areas, that I might have not had quite the same experience. But my experience with the faculty was very, very good. It was more an issue of institutional practice that bothered me. That was this exclusionary hiring instance. And then some of the students were, I think, one of the other outgrowths of this whole development is that the students are becoming more and more afraid themselves of inquiry. And one example that I can give, very concrete example, is when I talked to them about Sunstone, you know, I said, oh, I know someone who wrote an article on Sunstone, you know, and they're like, Sunstone? You shouldn't be reading that, and we don't read that. And the kind of closing down, that they get these subliminal and not so subliminal messages of what they're supposed to do and what they're not supposed to do. Don't see the R-rated movie, even if it's something like Schindler's List. They're becoming. I think that they're even the very bright ones are feeling threatened by the heavy atmosphere of what what now is going to be defined as Mormon and what is going to be defined as not Mormon. And that was where my real concern lies, more than in the idea that there need to be a lot of outsiders there, but how are you going to define Mormonism? Yeah.
One more question.
Did you get a chance to air your concerns to powers that be?
Oh, I aired. Well,
I mean, outside of the department, I mean, did you feel like there was any kind of a dialogue that you pierced some kind of?
Well, no, not out. With my colleagues in the department, we discussed these things. And one of the issues that's very difficult with hiring practice is that it immediately becomes particularized. That is, if you start to object to the hiring practice, it sounds like you're objecting to an individual. And that wasn't the message that I wanted to bring across. I didn't want to say, well, you shouldn't have this practice because I don't want to hire this individual. So most of the conversations took place with the people in the department, and I didn't feel much hope as an outsider in gaining the ear of someone who was in a position of authority. Maybe that's not fair, but I didn't feel that I had that hope. I was much more hopeful of like gaining the ear of my colleagues and saying, "Now you guys go do something because I'm leaving." But one of the reasons I'm here was because I also wanted to reach the people in the community who might be interested by these issues, and that's why I wanted to come. It's not so useful to talk to people who aren't interested in listening to you. I guess that's it. Argeen, did you want to ask something?
Well, if we have a moment, it would be interesting for us to hear about your expectations and how they might be realized or unrealized in visiting the center.
Going to the conference here?
Yeah.
I'm very excited by what takes place here. This is what I imagine being what Mormonism could be if it were inquiring. Mm-hmm. And I think what the comments that Neela made about the closing down of inquiry that takes place happens from the top down on an institutional basis, I'm afraid, rather frequently. But my sense of the community was very different. I got the sense from my students that despite their fears, which they were negotiating with a lot of trepidation, that a lot of them had real curiosity. And the kinds of issues that are being handled here, discussed here at Sunstone, validate that for me. I think that there are things being discussed, and I'm just sorry that the students that I knew at BYU, the rank and file, that don't feel comfortable with some of these discussions.
On that note, may I just say thank goodness for the diversity, for Mormons and non-Mormons. And I had a non-Mormon neighbor in California, and I'd give her little articles to read that I thought were nice. It wasn't doctrine, but it was just nice little things to... And by the time we got through visiting for a while, she didn't swear anymore. Thank you. Enjoyed having all of you.